Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where, you know, we talk about all sorts of things. We were the nuclear view when we first started, but as we've talked about broader topics, we moved from the nuclear view to the NIDS view, which is sort of an appropriate change in name. But today we have what I think is probably a great topic that a lot of listeners will be interested in. Of course, I'm talking about the recent attack on the U.S. attack on Fordo and Natanz and Isfahan. And, you know, so we've got that, you know, this was, I live in Kansas City. And, you know, the funny thing is I was just at the change of command over at the 509th a couple days before that attack happened. So, you know, my daughter, Abby, who goes with me to all the events at Whiteman, you know, she was like, "Dad, we were just there and we were just standing in front of the B-2s." So it was exciting for her to see that. And so if we start on sort of the timeline, so if we go back to this past weekend, and on Saturday morning at midnight, it was midnight Eastern time, that's when the bombers, the B-2s, took off, and they flew, you know, it was about, you know, it was over 12 hours, and then they get to, they go into Iran's airspace at about 5 p.m. Eastern, and then they hit their targets at about 6:45-ish, which was about 2:10, 2:30 a.m. on a Sunday morning in Iran, and they drop 14 GBU-57s on these separate sets of targets at Fordo and Natanz. And then, of course, there were F-22s and F-35s that were part of that. And then, of course, those aircraft do not land. They get refueled. That's one of the things the United States does better than anybody, and that's aerial refueling. And then it took about 36 hours, until those aircraft were back here in Missouri. And, you know, from what we're told, from what we've heard President Trump say and what we've read, the mission went off quite well. They apparently had B-2s that, you know, broke off and or flew to, you know, flew out to the Pacific as a sort of an effort to mislead. And apparently radars in Iran never picked them up. And so, you know, there's some discussion, and I heard a presser today with the president, because he's at the NATO meetings, and he said that, you know, there was a question of, well, how much destruction was it? And what we're told is that, you know, they were totally destroyed, and that we now have BDA that's, you know, we're now 3 days later, 4 days later. So we've seen more, and that there is, you know, success in the destruction of those targets, particularly at Fordo. And so that's kind of where we are right now. And of course, the great thing about NIDS is we've got all kinds of folks that are part of NIDS. And so, of course, Jim Petrosky, and, you know, Curtis is gone this week. So Dakota Rudisill, who was with us a few weeks ago, you know, he's a professor of law at Ohio State University. And so he's, you know, who better to set in for Curtis this week than Dakota, because we've got both, you know, engineering and legal questions to talk about, you know, for this attack on Iran. So let me start with you, Jim. So maybe walk us through this attack. I mean, what do we need to understand from the perspective of, I mean, you're a weapons effects guy. Like, you're the guy. Like, you're the guy who's going to rewrite Gladstone and Dolan and have done all the calculations. We know you know nuclear effects. Of course, these were conventional weapons, but you know them too. You're a career engineer. So tell us about kind of what do listeners need to understand about these strikes?
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank Dakota for coming on. He has a great portfolio. I'm anxious to hear what he has to say, because physics is physics. The laws of physics stand. The laws of man, they change around so much, they're hard to follow. So I like being in an organization, as Adam said earlier, as we were doing the warm-up, that I never change. Well, that's because the physics never changes. It's pretty easy to handle here. So before I talk about these actual weapons here, let me give you an example, something I often use when we talk about kinetic energy weapons. And if you have armaments at home, bow and arrow and a rifle, you can try these things out, because I've always said if the big EMP goes up and I had to survive, I would probably get a crossbow versus a rifle. One, because I can return my ammunition, but number two, you get an interesting kinetic effect from a very long a long bullet or a long projectile like you have in a bow. If you take a piece of glass and you set down a sandbag in front of it, and this is relevant to what we're talking about. I always like using good examples. You take a sandbag and stick it in front of a piece of glass and shoot it with even a 357. It'll hit that sandbag and energy will be dispersed over a very short period of time and probably not break the glass behind it. But if you take a bow and arrow, especially a good crossbow, and you shoot that arrow in, it'll go through the sandbag, through the glass, and stick itself in the wall. Because it's got the extra mass and it's got that extra kinetic energy that as it hits, it continues to maneuver forward. It's the idea behind the sabre rounds that takes out takes out tanks, etc. And it's a good example to understand what happens with these bunker busters. Because it's not, we'll go back to nuclear effects. It's not just a kilotonnage, it's how it connects to the target. So let me go back to what happened. So yes, in this raid, I wasn't part of it. So I'm going to make up my story as I want to, based upon what I know in the physics. But you have a massive ordnance penetrator, basically a 30,000 pound bomb. It's got a lot of mass, okay, a lot of weight, and it's dropped from a very high altitude, and it's designed aerodynamically so it can fly at a very, very high speed as it drops from the sky. And so at a very high speed, like I said, from a crossbow, it hits the ground at a very high speed, and the projectile kinetically connects to the ground and penetrates into the ground. And it's important to understand that penetration. And when you have an explosion occur, for example, on the surface, all the energy gets reflected from the surface and bounces up. And so therefore, the energy doesn't do the damage below as much as it does above. And we've seen that, I'll go back to nuclear explosions. Nuclear explosions below the ground are different than explosions above the ground. And here what you have is you have a tamping effect from that projectile as it hits the ground. And these weapons are designed to penetrate deeply, deeply, deeply into the ground. Down, I think they said on the news, I don't have any of the classified numbers, but I know they can easily penetrate hundreds of feet of earth. And once they get under the ground, now the explosive can couple with everything around, couple with the earth around it, and basically shake and break and destroy items that are in any facilities below the ground. Before I turn it over to Dakota, I want to mention that recently I've begun to look into energy resilience. And I will say in Iran, they took these facilities and put them underground because that's a good idea if you want to survive a kinetic attack, because the protection of the earth itself. It's hard to get down there. But the United States, through our incredible engineering effort, through our incredible military and our military-industrial complex, have been able to build this, because here's the trick. Here's the fundamental problem with this and what we've been able to overcome. And that is that you have an explosive and you have a mechanism, a timing mechanism on that explosive. And that entire system has to survive the impact of a high-speed projectile hitting the ground and penetrating down 100 feet. That's an incredible feat if you think of it from the standpoint of a mechanical system and electronic system. I mean, you put your body, think about my body. You put your body into a car and you hit an object at 100 miles an hour. And even if your seatbelts hold you in place, all your guts and everything else, I like to talk about these kind of things. All your guts and everything else are flying around inside your body. In this system, it's all got to function and continue to function until it gets 100 feet down or more. Through all that impact, through all the heat, through all the compression, through all the shaking, and then function. And what's miraculous, in my opinion, although I really respect the pilots that drop these and the radars and the techniques and the skills of doing that, I'm impressed with the fact that every single one of these dropped, hit the ground, penetrated, and exploded on time, on target, at the right place. What a phenomenal engineering experience. And that's why I'm proud to be an engineer. Back to you, Adam.
Well, so you bring up, I don't know if this was your question, Dakota, but that you sort of covered this, Jim. And my question was, as you're penetrating, because I was, reading about, GBU-57s, and they're supposed to penetrate 200 feet of earth before they detonate. And, I was sort of, it can't be just a solid piece of metal. It's not, like a rod from God or anything like that. It's got an explosive that has to go off at the right depth,
A fuse, a delay circuit. It has detonators that are in place. It has ordnance on it that, of course, is explosive. Now, of course, it's designed not to explode on the impact, but after it comes to its location, Adam. That's my point. This is an incredibly...
How do you build that? How do I get my weapon to go? I mean, I can see something sort of like the natural speed of a weapon hitting the earth, and then, as rapidly as it buries itself, it then detonates. But this one's going down deeper, way deeper than that, and then detonating. And so I can see that as it makes contact, it buries, and then it detonates, and in that sort of, less than a second, good things happen. But this one takes more time. So how do you build it to do that?
Well, the first piece is, you got to have insensitive explosives, but, insensitive explosive will not explode on impact. I mean, if you think about, glycerin, of course, you bounce it, it explodes, and dynamite, et cetera, but also it won't explode through the heat. So you have insensitive explosives. By the way, our nuclear weapons, part of their safety program, is that they have insensitive explosives as well, so that they do not detonate when they're not supposed to, but under the very specific conditions of the pressure from the detonator and the pressure and the heat from the detonator, they explode. So you start out the explosive, then you have the electronic circuit that has to be designed. And I've never designed these. So, I'm talking just as a physicist, contemplating what's here. But you have to have a circuit that's designed inside of a capsule in such a way that the wires and the components are well tested and well analyzed. This is a really... people think about it. This is a material science problem.
Oh yeah.
And, people talk about, nuclear engineers this and everything, but this is a material science problem where the compression of the body of that projectile and all the protective components of the circuits and all the circuitry. And you think about, your TV, your computer, pick up your laptop right now and slap it around a little bit. And then after you log back on and talk to me, understand all those electronics, are not designed, to handle that kind of a shake and a rattle or the heat. All of that's happening at the same time. And we have similar things happen in space, of course, when we, re-enter the atmosphere, et cetera. But this is just a phenomenal. Can you imagine the G-forces that are, felt by that system when that thing impacts the ground and begins to go deep, 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 100 feet underground? It's just impressive. So I probably didn't answer your question because I've never designed this, but I imagine this to be a solid bar, probably made out of tungsten. I'm sure it's been tested. To me, testing and analysis is the main point. I'm sure there's components of this that are designed specifically for this purpose through many years of testing. And probably learned a lot from our space program, probably learned a lot from impact analysis, from anything from collisions, et cetera, to maybe even some of our nuclear research, because, by the way, we were in hypersonics before hypersonics were cool. But anyway, and we learned those things, as we did that kind of testing. I don't know if that fully answers it, but those are the pieces that would have to go into that.
Yeah. That's interesting. So let me turn to you, Dakota. Now, there were two sort of big questions that, you know, the media and others were asking. The first one was, you know, there were some who said, well, the president has a requirement to come to Congress and get congressional approval before he launches an attack like this, which, you know, we know presidents do this kind of stuff, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. They all do it and they don't go to Congress. So can you talk about that? And then the second part was, you know, are there any international, you know, laws or anything that sort of impact this to make it, you know, legal, illegal, you know, where is international law?
Yeah, well, first, just thanks, James, for that description from an engineering standpoint. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, just where I just say as an aside, where my mind was going was the broader kind of theory of war and use of force principle, that what you want to produce a series of situational balances that you win. And so it's not necessarily who's got the bigger army or the bigger economy. It's like, can you win a series of situational victories that, you know, add up to victory? And here it's like, you know, at the surface, the front end of the weapon is winning. 5 feet down, the front end of the weapon is winning. 10 feet, right, like all the way down to 200, right? And it's, so obviously your bomb is much smaller than planet Earth, right? But the bomb wins a long time. Anyway, I just really enjoyed that. So on the law, something I actually know something about versus physics. So, basically there are two buckets of issues here. Both of them have gotten some interesting discussion in recent days about this. And I don't know if there's I don't know if there's necessarily a definitive answer here about legal or illegal. There's a lot of gray area, but I'll just try to just really, really briefly sketch out, what the issues and the controversy are here. So under the Constitution, there're basically three bases under which the United States can use force abroad under U.S. law under the Constitution. So one of those is Congress can authorize it explicitly, and they could do that via a war declaration, or Congress could pass a force authorization statute, such as the one that was after 9/11, and they were passed for the Iraq wars. So number one is congressional authorization. That hasn't happened here, so we have to move on. A second one is that the president can rely on the president's authority to conduct foreign affairs and or serve as commander-in-chief of the armed forces under Article 2 of the Constitution in order to use force. And there are basically two Article 2 theories. And the first one is what the framers at the Constitutional Convention called the power to repel sudden attacks. Those were the words, and the idea was straightforward. You know, if the British suddenly attack out of Canada, especially at that time, right, it could take days or weeks to get Congress together to debate this. The president should be able to just order U.S. forces into action, right, to deal with a sudden attack. A tougher issue is the question of preemption, right, of striking first. And this got really interesting and continues to be interesting in the nuclear deterrence context. But basically, the principle here is that, you know, if it looks like the nation is facing, you know, the nation, its forces, people overseas, right? They're facing imminent attack, and that's pretty clear to the president. Does the president need to wait around for the hammer to hit, or can the president act first, right? But coming back again to what the framer said, repel sudden attacks, it sounds like it's got to be pretty imminent. And so the Justice Department has said for quite a while that if it's basically the U.S. use of force pursuant to the president's Article 2 constitutional authority, if it's, you know, it's not an imminent threat, and instead it's planned, it's premeditated, right, and Congress hasn't authorized it, basically if it's intense enough, the president has to go to Congress and get authority for that. The problem is, just the difficulty here, and there's so much gray area, is that the Justice Department says, in view of the constitutional architecture, where Congress has the power, you know, to declare war, and the framers plainly wanted Congress to be in any sort of discretionary war question, right? Congress would be very, very central to that. When does a first use of force ordered by the president, when is that war in the constitutional sense that would require Congress, right, to authorize basically a premeditated U.S. attack and not a response to a sudden attack, right? Or if it's something smaller than that, right, like a smaller use of force. And so now we get to basically the third bucket of legal basis under the Constitution for use of force. And this is another Article II presidential constitutional power theory. And it's the idea that the president can order the armed forces to use force to protect important national interests. And so this third bucket is use of force that can be kinetic, can blow all sorts of stuff up, can kill people, but it's not war in the constitutional sense that would require Congress to authorize that in advance. And so the Justice Department over the decades, over Republican and Democratic administrations, developed some criteria for trying to figure that out. When are we talking about a first use of force by the president that amounts to war in the constitutional sense? And they have criteria such as basically the scale of the attack, its intensity, the risk of escalation to something pretty big, the risk to U.S. forces. These are the typical criteria. And so this has been getting a lot of discussion now in the context of a report that the president sent to Congress on June 23rd, as the president is obligated to do under the kind of there's a framework statute for use of force called the War Powers Act. And that is, it does not authorize force, but it basically has reporting requirements and some limitations on whatever force might be used. And one of the requirements is that if the president introduces U.S. forces into hostilities, the president, one of the requirements is the president has to report to Congress about this within 48 hours, so Congress becomes aware of it. So President Trump sent the report and cited his Article II authority as basically to conduct foreign affairs for this, and said we're coming to the defense of our ally Israel, had some brief words in there about national interest, and you know basically that there was not going to be a lot of danger to U.S. troops. But it's been very controversial because what President Trump's letter does not address in any sort of substantial way is the massive risk of escalation. And you know, on the policy side, right, there's been all sorts of conversation about this, right? Like, what is Iran's response going to be? Could it be against U.S. forces in the region? Could it be terrorism against Americans here at home? Could it be cyber attacks, which Iran has launched against the United States in past years, right? And that criterion has made this really, really controversial and has led a number of people who are very thoughtful on foreign affairs, you know, to say that this was not legal under the Constitution because just the risk of escalation. I mean, even if those 14 weapons, right, even if they themselves were, you know, it was 14 weapons, right? Like that doesn't look like a war, right? That looks like a strike, a big airstrike, but still a strike, right? But it's that risk that, you know, because Iran's nuclear program is so important to that regime, right, that there's massive risk of escalation to a wider conflict, you know, with the United States, with U.S. allies in the region, you know, maybe attacking the U.S., like that would amount to war, right? So that's why that's controversial on the U.S. law side.
Dakota, the piece that I have a difficult part wrapping my head around, because, you know, people shooting at each other, eventually it becomes a war. Okay, we're sending armaments across in other countries. Is there a clear definition of what is war versus what is a conflict versus what is a, you know, what is a
special military operation?
They're all sort of very unclear, and that's why probably we get a lot of discussion. Can you help our audience understand that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll do my best. So the problem is there's no hard answer to this. There's no definition in U.S. law about war versus armed conflict versus police action You know, versus, you know, there just isn't. The Constitution uses this term war. Congress shall have the power to declare war. The War Powers Act says that, you know, the president needs to report when introducing U.S. forces into hostilities. But then the statute, the War Powers Act statute that Congress passed in 1973 does not define hostilities. So we have some ambiguity. On the side of international law, which is the other big body of law which bears on this question, similarly here, there's not a treaty or something like that which makes clear what's a war versus armed conflict versus a special military operation, right? And the way that nation states have responded to this ambiguity in the last 100 years, basically, and especially since World War II, is that they use the terms like war and, you know, military operations and whatnot in kind of a colloquial sense. But kind of the core concept now in international law is what's called armed conflict. And armed conflict just means you've got, you know, at least one nation state. Oh, I guess you could have sub-nation states. Anyway, you just have, like, basically it's like organized political violence at a pretty significant level, right? It's a nation state's army, right? Or it's like a guerrilla force, you know, or, you know, something like that. They're organized, right? And they're using kinetic force against each other, or, well, now cyber too, because, you know, we're, that's kind of a new frontier of armed conflict. But that's kind of the central concept. And that's been just in a practical way, it's been helpful to set aside this question of like, well, what's a full war in an international sense, right? And what's a special military operation, right? It's armed conflict. And so I could just say a word too about some of the conflict, about some of the controversy there about this strike. And I'll try to be more concise than I just was. So the baseline under international law, which is, so international law here, it's a combination of treaties and it's what's called customary international law, which is basically just how states behave in connection with their claims that we're doing this because of legal obligation. Basically, it's just like practice. And the U.S. we're signed up to a lot of the key treaties and accept a lot of customary international law, not all of it, but a lot of it. Anyway, so international law here has a baseline that states can't use force and they can't threaten the use of force. But there are some big exceptions to that. One of them is that the UN Security Council has authorized the use of force. A second one is the inherent right of self-defense to a country that's attacked. And there's also defense of others. And, you know, it just really kind of makes sense. Like, I sometimes analogize this for my students to, like, domestic law, right? Like, you know, the government in certain domestic settings, right, can authorize use of force, right? Like the police, right? They are legally authorized to use force in certain circumstances, right? Also, you have your inherent right of self-defense. Someone breaks your nose, right? And, you know, or if somebody, you know, breaks your brother's nose standing right next to you, you can engage in defense of others. Right, it's basically the same under international law, and so those are the principles. And so on the defense issue, the thorny issue there, especially in this conflict, is again coming back to this preemption issue. You know, at what point does that inherent right of self-defense also authorize you to use force before the blow lands? And there's a great deal of debate about this. And what Israel decided was that in their estimation, the threat from Iran's nuclear program had grown severe, so severe that they had to act, right? And that they're acting in anticipatory self-defense. And there's no, you know, and so it's that, you know, it's pushing the self-defense concept as far as it can go because the UN Security Council has not authorized the use of force here. Iran, you know, here, right, did not fire missiles first at Israel, right? Israel acted first. And then it got even kind of it was pushed even a bit farther then. But then when the United States joins the armed conflict between Israel and Iran, right, basically supporting Israel in their inherent, in their claim of inherent right of anticipatory self-defense, right? So we're doing defense of others, right? Where that brother of yours standing next to you, right? They swung first, right? So that's why this is so controversial. And the Trump administration obviously thought that Israel's use of force was legal, and so therefore America's helping them out was legal. But all sorts of scholars and practitioners who say no, you're just pushing this too far, and that there was no imminent threat, right? It's not like Iran had a ballistic missile on the pad with a nuke on the top, and there were indications they were going to fuel it and fire it, right? It's at some point in what, weeks, months, a couple of years, they're going to have a weapon. Yeah. And we don't know if they can mate it with a missile, right? So that's the convo right there right now.
Well, there's two use cases. Previously, of course, Iraq, when Israel took out the EMIS facilities in Iraq, and of course in Lebanon, when they took out the nuclear reactors that were for plutonium production there. So those, I think, even better use cases, because they were further away from being able to create a nuclear weapon than at least what we hear is Iran. I'm, not in the intel community. So, but that would looking at that from an international law standpoint.
Yeah. Well, so yeah. And so much here when we're in this, so when you don't have the UN Security Council authorizing force, and, you don't have another state attacking first, right? It's anticipatory self-defense. Here, the power of the precedent gets really thick. Because it's shaping customary international law, and the one that you meant, one of them that you mentioned was the Israeli strike on the Iraqi nuclear facility. I think it was it Osirak? Is that right? I think it was 1981.
Yes, it was an EMIS. It was a production facility, but it was exactly the same concept that we have here.
Yeah. Well, and so what's thorny about that for the Trump administration is that the Reagan administration condemned that and voted for a resolution condemning it as a violation of international law. And so that's a little tricky. Now, countries can change their position on customary international law. That would basically be up to the president as chief diplomat of the United States to do that. I'm sure President Trump would have no compunction at all. And he's basically inherently saying, right, that, without saying it, right, that the Reagan administration's position in 81 was wrong. And it's okay to do this kind of thing.
I know we're short of time. Well, we're out of time. But the one thing I wanted to ask was, I don't equate this as beginning with Israeli strikes on Iran. I would say this started on October the 7th, over 2 years ago. And so therefore there's, the Iranians have hit Israel multiple times with barrages over the last couple of years. I mean, they're the ones that fund Hamas. They're the ones that were funding Hezbollah when Hezbollah started attacking Israel in the north. And so, Iran has been sort of the key agitator, funder, supporter, armor, and they've already struck Israel with, with their drones and other stuff twice. So the war had long begun. It wasn't that the targets changed slightly, when Israel started, 14 days ago, but they've been at war for, 2.5 years. So almost 3 years now, I guess. So I'm not quite sure why any legal scholar would say, well, this is something other than a continuation of war that had already begun, almost 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, I think that's an excellent point. And what's going on there is figuring out basically like when it starts. And the problem is that there's a lot of things that have happened over a number of years, and they've varied widely in intensity, typically not been, they haven't been right missile strikes on the scale that we were seeing, between Israel and Iran. So that's why it's a little bit unclear about like at what point, does it actually does you know do you know did some sort of like situation of armed conflict between Iran and Israel actually start? And so who really struck first?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we could probably continue this discussion for much longer because there's so many great, many great topics, and you know, it's between the, you know, the technical aspects of actually accomplishing the strikes, and then the legal aspects of it. It's, you know, it's just it's a fascinating topic, but unfortunately, as a podcast that strives to be about 30 minutes long, we unfortunately have to cut the discussion off. So Dakota, Jim, of course, thanks for being here for another great discussion. It's always interesting. This one, you know, we've had some significant events in the world that sort of lend to us having a great podcast. So that was, I guess, unfortunate, but you know, here we are. So of course I want to remind all of our listeners, you know, go read GSR, listen to, you know, Real Space Strategy and Deterrence Down Under. You know, there's Peter Husey events coming up soon. There's just so much going on at NIDS. So stay engaged. And, you know, there's just a lot to keep you informed. Jim?
Adam, I'd like to highlight, we have Uzi Rubin talking this Friday at our Peter Husey event, and he's speaking from Israel. So it'll be really interesting to hear him talk as, you know, someone that's right in the middle of the fray. So that's the kind of stuff we're bringing to everybody. You can get in on that and be able to ask your own questions and interact with the people there. So just go to thinkdeterrence.com and sign up. Back to you, Adam.
All right, Dakota, Jim, thanks. And of course, to all you, the listeners, we want to, as always, remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.